little something between you and me. Don't cost you nothing, this one's for free.
And you've already given us some sort of attempts at a diagnostic or a definition, if you wish. These are some that are out there. Persistent bodily complaints for which adequate examination does not reveal sufficient explanatory structural or other pathology. I'm quite attracted to that one. Physical symptoms that cannot be explained by organic pathology, which distress or impair the functioning of the patient. Yeah. Slightly different take on the word function, because that's talking about the function of the patient rather than the function of the body or mind, or minded body or embodied mind. Or the person has the unexplained symptoms after appropriate assessment, testing, and time have displayed nothing. I mean, there's bits in all of those. So various people have done typologies of this, and I have used quite a lot. There's an ABC of medically unexplained physical symptoms, which I have used quite a lot. It's written by a guy called Chris Burton, who's a GP now based in Sheffield, who's got a very special interest in this, has done a lot of research. He's bright button. And so quite a lot I've used some of his stuff. So that one thing is pain in different locations, functional disturbance of organ systems, or complaints of fatigue or exhaustion. I mean, I think that's kind of a slightly weird, arbitrary, you know, people with pain have exhaustion. People, pain could be argued as a functional disturbance of a system. Chris Burton's typology, I think, is quite helpful. There's three overlapping sets here. You've got people with symptoms, and he's put with a low probability of disease. What I would put is with a low probability of structural findings, structural disorder. And then you've got functional somatic syndromes, such as IBS, and then you've got multiple long-standing symptoms. And I think that that's helpful to distinguish that lot, multiple long-standing symptoms, because I think once someone has had multiple symptoms in multiple systems over a long period of time, we're in a very different ballpark in terms of what we may or may not be able to help them achieve. Here's a possible solution. Well, that's just a way of cutting up that same territory. That's part of Chris Burton's typology. I don't think we'll spend too much time on that. But let me ask you this. If we are trying to divide the difficulties that people have into structural things that we can see or measure or are not the way the structures are meant to be designed, and functional, which is way the system works, what is migraine? Is migraine a functional or a structural disorder?
It could be both, actually.
Yeah.
The hypothesis says it's because of the constriction of too much blood flow into the brain, that is the trigger of migraine. But it's not proven. Coffee helps, for example. And some other medications, we know sumatriptan, for example, for acute. But if it is structural or the other one, something
functional,
a mixture of both.
Okay, other people's thoughts. You're very happy to diagnose migraine, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it a structural disorder or is it a functional disorder? Or is that...
It just happens.
An unusual question.
But we don't really know definitely what causes it, do we? I think it's a bit of a grey area.
Yeah.
We don't know whether it's kind of neurotransmitter related or whether it's vascular related or both. But there's certainly, it's a very individual thing, isn't it? Because different people have different triggers. So someone, it can be very predictable if they miss a meal, or so it, then it makes you more think, oh, it's kind of functional because it has got that twist to it. So okay. I'd agree. I think it's probably both.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a cop out.
Okay. What about IBS?
I can say the same.
What's, what, yeah, go on.
So, yeah, there's some theories, but we don't know exactly what's causing it. And every patient's different. So some of them, it's psychological, actually. Whenever they're stressful, they don't have symptoms. But some patients, they will have like some element of, like, what can I say, structural problem with it. So I think it's kind of individual based thing, and sometimes can have both functional and structural.
It's interesting how some of these diseases all happen together. So like I don't know whether this is true, but people who've got fibromyalgia are a lot more likely to have IBS or a lot. So it's kind of like little clusters of these things, which kind of makes me think perhaps.
And there is a serious discourse suggesting that functional disorders should be just a single category. Mm. I don't buy that, but because I don't think it's very useful as an idea. Mm-hmm. But my point is, you're not uncomfortable with diagnosing migraine at all. Mm-hmm. You don't think twice about it, okay? You're mostly, because you're young, comfortable with diagnosing IBS. But when we were young...
We never used to be comfortable with diagnosing it.
That used to be something that you didn't like doing. In the same way as you're still uncomfortable with diagnosing fibromyalgia. Or chronic fatigue syndrome, and very uncomfortable with diagnosing myalgic myeloencephalitis or whatever it is. So I just float those. Now, actually, I am doing another version of this, and I put it on this morning. Depression. Is that a functional or a structural disorder?
Again, it can be both, because it can be a reactive depression to something, or people who literally just have it out of the blue with no trigger, and because it is a neurotransmitter problem, then I'd be more likely to say that could be structural.
Okay, but do people who have a reactive depression have normal neurotransmitter profiles?
I've never tested that. I don't know. I'm not sure, but I think it's more situational rather than a neurotransmitter.
So what is very interesting, sorry to interrupt. Yeah. What is very interesting is we keep muddling up our explanatory model and cause. You said, well, that's okay, because it's psychological. You said it's psychological. Some of it is psychological and some of it isn't. And it's reactive. We know, you know, it's related. So that's more functional. But if it comes on out of the blue like Sylvia Plath's bell jar, that's more structural.
But it still might be affecting the neurotransmitters, even if it is a reactive.
Yes.
If,
you know, so here's another little quandary for you, just to bend your brains a bit more. So if you give, there's an experiment where you give people a pain stimulus. These are people that are not opiate naive. So they've had opiates in the past and respond to them. You give them a pain signal, pain stimulus, and then you give them either a placebo or an opiate. What happens? They don't know which they've got, of course. What happens?
They feel better, I think. Yeah.
So both feel better. People with the opiates feel slightly more better than the people with placebo, but the placebo people definitely feel better.
Yeah.
Now, unbeknown to either group, you then give them naloxone. What happens?
So not known to the group?
No. Not known to either group.
Okay.
Nothing, I would say.
Nothing? Any other? Do we all agree with Joe? Nothing happens? You give them it and they don't know they're getting it?
They have a loss of benefit.
So, hold on. They're in pain. You've given one lot of opiates, one lot of placebo. They both got less pain at this point. But, you know, the placebo people have got slightly poorer pain control than the people on opiates, still got their pain, the stimulus. You give them a naloxone, which is an opiate channel reverser, blocker. They, neither of them know it. You're saying neither of them get any recurrence of pain.
I think so. The same.
Okay.
Friend.
So you would logically think that if you give naloxone to people who've been getting pain relief from opiates and you reverse the opiate effect, they would get more pain.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yeah.
And you would logically think that people who had a placebo pain relieving effect would not get any change because they wouldn't know that they'd been given naloxone. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that they both get more pain. Mm. So neither of them knew they were getting an opiate reverser. One didn't have any opiates on board.
Oh, that
makes sense.
Opiates, mm-hmm.
Oh.
Things or something.
Oh. Yeah. So believing that something might make you better changes structural things, physiological things. So this is all by way of saying it's the model we've got isn't fit for the task that is in front of us. That we think things where we're comfortable with explanations are real, and things that we're not uncomfortable with explanations are unreal. And we transmit that to patients and then wonder why these people irritate us and we irritate them. Yeah? So that's my first salvo, that it's complicated. So some helpful early thoughts: mind and body and context are indivisible. You may, for the purposes of trying to navigate territory, want sometimes to think about them separately, but it's often unhelpful. So after a heart attack, what predicts better your chance of dying? Having been given a clot-busting drug during your heart attack or being depressed? It's obvious that I would ask the answer from the way I asked the question, being depressed. But hold on, how can that be? A heart attack is about as structural an illness as you can imagine. It's gummed up. You know, there's blockage. Surely if they're going to die, it must be because something structural happens. How could depression possibly...
Like the cortisol and stress that it puts on the heart. Is there not a condition where people can actually die of a broken heart? So
yeah,
mm. Yeah, it's called Takotsubo syndrome. Yes. Something weird. That. It's an amazing that...
Yeah.
And it can happen that people so... And that's the chemical release due to something that we could say is functional in a way that can kill them.
Yes.
I saw something about people's mortality rates after a heart attack, and they compared married people who had visitors to lonely people who maybe lived alone or didn't have family, who didn't have any visitors, and the mortality rates were much more in the without the support. So
what could conceivably be happening?
Well, they've got nothing to live for, you could say.
Yes, but how can that affect their heart? That's a structural thing.
And you hear of all these couples who one of them dies, elderly couples who one of them dies and the other one dies within a few weeks or months. There's something in it.
So you can't. So my point is, you can't
separate them.
You can't have a thought without a physical substrate.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have anything without chemicals changing. And the idea that if you've been depressed for a week, the physiology of your brain or your muscles or anything else is the same as the physiology of a person who's been depressed for 10 years. It's patently stupid when you think about it. How can those two things be the same? And yet we just call them depression. You know, have you got five of the characters? You must be moderately depressed, you know. But it's a nonsense that all of the things that you do when you're depressed or don't do, the deconditioning of your muscles, the lack of stimulation of parts of your brain, the continuous lack of endorphins, the rise in your hypopituitary adrenal axis, and all of the swishing chemicals that go around your body for years and years. You know, when you look at someone who's in, if you look at a poor person, they look older than a rich person of the same age. And that isn't because the air they breathe is so different. It's because when you're poor, shit happens. And that has an effect on your body and your mind. And that has an effect on the way in which your body behaves and your mind. So what I think is really helpful is to start, is to stop thinking that these things are separated at all, at any point, and to start thinking all the time about function and structure, and the ways in which they're blended and complex over time, develop, but how something is, how it looks in the world.
Let's hear it for our GP. Skills improving, risk removing, no confusion.